After first asking for an extension to complete the census count, a sudden U-turn. The impact on Texas could last for a decade or more. Details today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. More women are unemployed now than at any time since the late 1940s, and women of color among the hardest hit. What some are calling America's first female recession, and what's behind it? Residents along the Gulf Coast finding more effective ways to deal with an active hurricane season amid a pandemic. Also, a claim that one in three Texans can't access health insurance. A PolitiFact check and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this fifth day of August 2020. I'm David Brown. Hope your Wednesday has been a good one so far. If the days seem to be racing by, well, it's not just your imagination. We are now exactly 90 days from what many consider to be one of the most consequential general elections in history. And yet there are huge gaps in what we know about how that election will be conducted as a practical matter amid this pandemic. There's another deadline looming that some argue could be even more far-reaching and have longer-lasting effects. And that deadline has actually been moved closer. The U.S. Census Bureau, considered the gold standard for demographic data in the U.S., has long been thought of as above politics. But its decision to reverse its request to extend the census period into next year has raised eyebrows and set off some alarm bells. The Census Bureau now says it will conclude its count on September 30th in order to meet President Trump's demand to complete the tabulation by year's end. Critics see this as a political move, more specifically an attempt to undercount minority and immigrant populations. But an undercount would touch nearly every Texan in one way or another, affecting congressional maps, where or if new schools are built, highway planning, federal aid programs, and much more, including how many seats Texas has on Capitol Hill. Lila Valencia is a senior demographer at the Texas Demographic Center. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Were you surprised by this announcement from the U.S. Census Bureau?
We were surprised. Initially, we had heard that the extension was going to go through October 31st, and we were going to be able to count people and people be able to respond through that date. And when it was moved up, we were just really concerned that the Census Bureau now has less time to do more work under unprecedented challenges.
When you say October 31st, we're talking about the difference of a month. Would that have made a large difference in the ability to count Texans or no?
So what's really being cut short by removing that month of October is the actual data collection, the actual counting of people. And so people were supposed to be able to respond, and Census Bureau enumerators were going to go door to door to get that count. Now the Census Bureau has less time to do that. And in Texas, that's over 500 million households that they have to go to be able to get that complete count.
Now, we talked with you back in early July when it was reported that Texas ranked 40th in the nation with only 57% of Texans who'd returned their census forms. Where are we now, and how does this new deadline affect that?
So we've moved up a little bit. We are at 39th, and we have a 57.9% response rate. So we still have, like I said, over 5 million households to count. Only one county has met its 2010 goal or its 2010 milestone from the decennial census in that decade. And so we are, the challenges before us are pretty great.
Well, is it possible perhaps to mobilize more volunteers to pull out the stops and try to get into some of these known underserved parts of Texas and get people to complete the census?
We have seen a recent uptick in the count in response rates in Texas, but also across the country. And we know that in part it's because the Census Bureau has started going door to door. For instance, in Texas, they are now in Dallas and in San Antonio and Austin later on this week. However, the hardest to count populations, the rural areas of the state and down in the Rio Grande Valley, they haven't gotten there yet. And so basically now they have less time to count the hardest to count populations in the state.
Sounds like you're saying that already all the stops had been pulled out. There's not a whole lot more that can be done in less time.
That's accurate. You know, when we started to see the challenges that were being presented to us by the pandemic, people were getting creative. All of the ground efforts were really pivoting and doing everything they could to try to get that count out. So that work was already underway.
So who's most at risk of being undercounted?
Well, Texas has a big portion of a population that is under the risk of being undercounted. We have over 5 million people that are considered to be living in hard-to-count neighborhoods. Many of them are going to be people of color, but it's also going to be areas of the state that are more disconnected. And so if they are in rural parts of the state, they are also a hard-to-count population.
Why this complete U-turn when it comes to the census count? Earlier, they had been pushing the count date forward, and now they're dialing it back to September 30th.
You know, that's difficult to say, but what we know is that the Census Bureau now has more work to do in less time, and it's really risking an undercount that's going to determine planning and services and representations for the communities of the state and the country for the next decade.
What's at stake for Texas if our population is undercounted?
Well, we have received billions of dollars in services that that are federal programs that come to the state in terms of emergency planning, educational grants, economic development, highway and construction planning. But we're also risking our representation. We used to be working under the assumption of the projections of Texas gaining 3 congressional seats. A severe undercount for the state would really put that at risk as well.
Lila Valencia is a senior demographer at the Texas Demographic Center. Lila, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Not since the late 1940s has unemployment for females in the U.S. been as high as it is now. That, according to a new report by The 19th, a nonprofit, nonpartisan online news organization that launched this week dedicated to women who make up more than half of the electorate and to other underrepresented people in U.S. politics and policy. The reporter on this story is Chibeli Carrizana. She is economy reporter for The 19th. How bad is it, Chibeli?
Well, it's been a very difficult year, I think, for all of us, David, but particularly for women. This is the first time that we are seeing a recession that is hitting women harder than it's hitting men. Of all of the jobs that we have lost this year due to coronavirus, 55% of those losses have gone to women.
That's remarkable. You report that female unemployment reached double digits for the first time since 1948, and that people of color, women of color, are especially hard hit, right?
That's right. I mean, if we look at the peaks this year, Black women unemployment was 16.5%. For Latinas, it was 20.2%. I mean, these are astronomical figures this year. And the reason for that is the jobs that women are concentrated in. So the jobs that are sensitive to social distancing, retail, hotel, restaurants, the jobs that went away, those are jobs predominantly held by women.
So why is it that given that a lot of these jobs, I mean, you're talking about a lot of the low-income workforce, grocery clerks, home health care workers, people that we associate with being part of the essential workforce, found themselves out of work. Does part of this have to do with stereotypical family roles or what?
So it's two things. Yes, women are also the majority of essential workers. 1 in 3 women are essential workers. The remaining women are women who, like you said, are in those low wage jobs that are very vulnerable to job losses in this time period. And then there's this other aspect, right? The women who went home, who are working remote, they are finding, if they're mothers, that the childcare aspect of this, the crisis that we are having with childcare in this moment, is really exacerbating this issue. And so we have women who are making the decision to leave the workforce altogether to care for children. And that's because in 2020, women still do the majority of childcare compared to fathers, even in couples where the couple is married and both are working full time. Women do more than 40% of that work.
But it's not just low-income workers that we're talking about, because women in professions are finding themselves feeling like they have to choose between their jobs and managing some of the educational needs of school-age children and that sort of thing, right?
Correct. So across the spectrum, you know, women are still less likely to be in managerial positions, less likely to be in positions that have more protection during coronavirus. It's not just low-wage workers, but women of all kinds. I talked to a lawyer in Miami who is deciding whether she's going to close her practice. I talked to a consultant in Austin who decided to completely leave her job because of the childcare issue. Their husbands or their partners typically make more than they do, and so they are the ones that are put in this position to make a difficult choice.
I want to back up here for just a moment, because in your story, I was struck by a statistic. You note that women only became the majority of the workforce, just over 50%, last December. And you think about the fact that it's taken decades for women to hit that mark. And I wonder how much the fears are that women will lose so much ground made since they entered the workforce in large numbers just a few decades ago, back in the 1970s, I think most sociologists point to.
Yeah, the 1970s was really the point where we started to see women's participation in the labor force increase. And you're right, that 50.04% is the figure in December 2019, when women surpassed men for only the second time in history in terms of the gender split in the labor force. And now in 3 months, coronavirus has erased a decade of that progress. And so all of those jobs that we have lost, that is going to have a long-term effect on the gender gap, on wage growth, and on graduates who are graduating into this market that has fewer jobs and jobs at lower salaries.
America's first female recession. We'll have a link to the story at texasstandard.org. Chabeli Carzana is economy reporter for the 19th News, which launched online this week. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Wells Dunbar is the Texas Standard social media editor, and he's been monitoring what Texans are talking about online. Hello again, Wells.
Hello, David. A stunning explosion in Beirut making shockwaves in American politics. I think you know what I'm talking about here. A warehouse full of ammonium nitrate exploded Tuesday at the port of Beirut, that blast raining destruction throughout the Lebanese capital. Video of the blast ricocheting across social media. On our Facebook page, Bill Gross notes it's very reminiscent of the 1947 event in Texas City when a ship loaded with ammonium nitrate exploded. Strangely enough, Bill adds, in both cases, the estimated amount of ammonium nitrate was north of 2,000 tons. CNN also reporting that President Trump, absent any evidence, alluded to the blast as intentional, calling it, quote, a terrible attack. Also via Facebook, John Blackley said, to a certain kind of politician, everything looks like an attack. Just a few of the responses we're seeing out there, David. Plenty more coming in via social media, and I'll be back with those reactions later in the show.
We'd love to hear from you, too. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he'll be back in 35. It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Tropical storm Isaias is blamed for the deaths of five people on the East Coast this week after threatening to be a much bigger and even deadlier storm. Just last week, South Texas was hit by Hurricane Hanna, a Category 1, and experts predict an active storm season. People who live in Texas's coastal region are familiar with preparing for and responding to such disasters, but responding during a medical disaster like COVID-19 at the same time complicates matters considerably. Lon Gonzalez reports a group in Corpus Christi is formed to do something about it.
Bring together various groups like Texas A&M Corpus Christi, the Coastal Bend Council of Governments, and the Heart Research Institute, and you have a unique partnership to help build community resilience. That resilience is key for communities after certain disasters. In our case here in South Texas, things like hurricanes and the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Katya Woke with the Heart Research Institute outlines the need for capacity in communities.
Funding is always an issue to recover from disasters like Harvey or Hanna or COVID-19. Funding is always an issue, but also people power can be a real problem. So, for example, emergency managers or floodplain administrators, stormwater management folks, economic development specialists, they already have full-time jobs, right? So when these disasters happen, we're also expecting these same people who have full-time jobs to recover from these events and help us build resilience along the way. So it becomes a problem of capacity. There's just not enough people in the seats to do the job.
The answer, says Dr. Woke, is to create partnerships with a hard focus on improving communities.
And we looked at what other folks are doing around the nation, and people are partnering. So councils of government around the nation or counties or cities are partnering with NGOs, nonprofit non-governmental organizations, or they're partnering with sometimes private institutions. And some of them are partnering with universities.
The Regional Resilience Project was also awarded federal money totaling to $800,000 to develop a GIS or geographic information system to help understand economic risk and resilience in areas of the Coastal Bend. Dr. Woke says the current project is focusing on four Coastal Bend counties, Aransas, Bede, Refugio, and San Patricio, with possible future expansion. A challenge, she adds, is understanding various assets and local issues, including economic issues.
Now, we can put this all into a map online so that everybody has the same understanding and can view all this information as we're thinking about how we develop in the Coastal Bend, making sure that we do it in a resilient way, that we're not putting more risk, building more risk to things like Hurricane Hannah or future storms.
While the project's partnership is working with communities, where does that leave unincorporated areas of the region?
This specific project won't be gathering additional data or doing like drone surveys or something like that, so we can map areas where we have no data. But at least we'll better understand where those gaps are, and then we can pursue even more funding to start to fill those gaps.
The work being done by the RRP is to help lower the risk of future issues. The entire project is also serving as a model for other areas of Texas and could expand in the future. The overall scheme is, for all intents and purposes, futuristic.
It is futuristic in that we want innovation and new technology, but it's also here and now. It's about building those relationships and understanding where you have capacity and expertise and where I do. How can we put that together to be stronger?
Even as a project is ongoing, the RRP is looking for membership expansion. In Corpus Christi, I'm Lon Gonzalez.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Gentrification has long been a powerful and polarizing issue in many Texas inner cities. Longtime residents feel they're being pushed out, with old neighborhoods and communities disappearing in the rush to profit. As Houston Public Media's Florian Martin reports, in the historic Fifth Ward, one developer argues gentrification can be a good thing if it's done right.
These houses are like 1,700 square feet. There's three bedrooms, two baths.
Chris Senegal is a real estate investor and developer. He's showing me one of the five townhomes he's built on a lot off I-69 and Liberty Road in Houston's Fifth Ward neighborhood. All are sold. Two of them have residents already. The other three are still being worked on.
So this particular block of property used to be an old abandoned grocery store and some rundown houses that were full of drugs and prostitution.
Senegal says he bought the property in 2013 and cleaned it up. The plan is to build nine more on the block. The homes go for $289,000 each. Senegal says he could ask a lot more.
When it comes to development, a lot of times there is a pretty significant spread between the cost of construction and the retail price per square foot.
He says he sacrificed some profit in favor of a plan to revitalize the community without changing its culture. It used to be a bustling center of the city's black life, but in recent decades, the Fifth Ward has been marked by poverty, with median household income just over $30,000 in 2015.
The young working professional that's worked hard to go to school, probably has a lot of student loans, and would love to move back to the neighborhood they grew up in, have no option, so they have to go to the suburbs. So this is a model that allows them to have an opportunity to live in the neighborhood as well.
The homes Senegal is building are all modern, gray, with attached garages, a noticeable deviation from the look of the buildings around them, mostly old one-story houses with chain-link fences around them. Clifton Suleri has lived in one of the old houses for the last 30 years. He only has one issue with the new development.
I can't see downtown anymore. I used to stand on my porch and look at downtown and look at the fireworks and everything else is going on down there, but now I can't.
Besides losing his view, Soleri also worries about his rent going up. He says he currently pays $560 a month. Zoe Middleton is with Texas Housers, an organization that advocates for affordable housing. She says gentrification is a concern in the Fifth Ward.
When we don't build homes that are affordable enough, or we don't subsidize the building of homes that are affordable enough, then people get pushed out of their neighborhoods and affordable rental homes disappear, and you get, you know, condos or luxury developments that aren't even that accessible to most Houstonians.
Middleton supports Senegal's concept of trying to get people previously off the neighborhood to move back, but she cautions that they should try to be part of the community despite the economic differences.
Really coming in and contributing to the neighborhood and helping to stabilize it and give it the vibrancy that all cities deserve.
That is what Devon Robinson is trying to do. He and his wife moved into one of Senegal's townhomes from Katy with their one-year-old son. He says they wanted to be in the city and around more people who look like them. He says he doesn't feel like a gentrifier because he shares the community's culture and he's trying to improve the area.
We've made maybe 24 calls to the city of Houston regarding, you know, picking up trash and fixing lights and, you know, repairing road work. As long as they understand that you're not there to take over and take from them what they've known as home for the last, you know, 20, 30 years, then they're appreciative of you, coming into the neighborhood.
Robinson says he hopes he and his family will contribute to turning the area around and that their son will appreciate growing up in the Fifth Ward. I'm Florian Martin in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. COVID-19 deaths across the state rose by 245 on Tuesday. The Department of State Health Services reports that brings the statewide total to 7,261 since the pandemic began. Confirmed coronavirus cases also increased by more than 9,100. The seven-day average for new cases has been on the rise again since Friday after falling slightly in late July. The Fort Worth City Council has approved a new contract with its police union despite calls to postpone the vote last night. As KERA's Miranda Suarez reports, the council first delayed the decision in June when racial justice protests were at their peak.
The new contract includes across-the-board annual raises for officers. That drew criticism from local activist group United Fort Worth, which says raises should be based on merit to avoid rewarding bad cops. This contract is also known as a meet and confer agreement. Fort Worth Police Union President Manny Ramirez says police reform can still happen, but it's a separate matter from what this contract negotiates.
This meet and confer agreement is not how you do it. This is a wages and benefits agreement that governs wages, benefits, working conditions, due process rights, protections. And that's it.
United Fort Worth also took issue with some of those due process rights, like a rule that gives officers under investigation 48 hours notice before their first interviews. The contract passed 8-1 with Councilmember Ann Zeta voting against. The contract will run until 2024. I'm Miranda Suarez in Fort Worth.
The real estate market for rural land in Texas has slowed considerably, tracking closely with an unprecedented decline in residential sales activity. Texas A&M University's Real Estate Center reports properties sold in remote areas fell nearly 9% in the second quarter compared to the first 3 months of the year. Research economist Charles Gilliland says, however, the coronavirus pandemic has increased interest in moving away from urban areas.
There seems to be some interest in getting even further out than the suburbs, finding a place out in the country that they can get away from it all, if you will.
Gilliland says rural land values in Texas increased by a modest 1.7% from April to June, but a continued slowdown in sales activity could spell falling property prices in 2021. And the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has committed at least $1 million to help MJ Hagar in her U.S. Senate campaign against Republican incumbent John Cornyn. The Texas Tribune reports it's the first time the committee has made such an investment in a general election in Texas. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. A year ago, we met Erica and Genesis Contreras, a mother and daughter who were inside the Cielo Vista Walmart in El Paso when a gunman opened fire. They were among an estimated 3,000 people at the store on that day, August 3rd, 2019. Shoppers came from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, many drawn there for back-to-school deals. 23 people were killed in what police say was a targeted attack on Latinos. When we first met Erica, she was trying to clean the smell of rotten food from her car. In the chaos, she'd thrown her groceries in the trunk, and then her car sat out in the sun for several days in the cordoned-off parking lot.
Butter was, like, literally liquefied.
KERA's Mallory Falk checked in with the family to see how they're doing a year after the attack.
This time last year, then-7-year-old Genesis Contreras was busy showing off her new school supplies.
I have this bag that I put all my pencils in. What is this called, Mom?
My pencil bag.
My pencil bag. Nice sheets of paper, folders.
This year, back to school's been delayed, and it's going to look very different. Because of the pandemic, Erica's chosen for her daughter to take virtual classes, one option offered by the district.
What I do like about virtual school is that I don't have to wear my shoes, and I get to be all comfortable and comfortable clothes
instead of her uniform.
And I get to wear chapstick. But what I am going to miss about school is my science class, my dance class, the computer lab, and the library.
Genesis is a pretty bubbly 8-year-old. Erica's grateful that what she went through last August didn't fundamentally change her personality.
During the day, she's her bouncy little self, but there's days when she says she doesn't know why she feels sad and she wants to start crying and she gets really emotional. And so we're still working on all that.
That Saturday morning in August, Erica and Genesis went to pick up groceries at their go-to Walmart. They wanted to make a special weekend breakfast. Erica's mom and sister were also headed to the store to pay some bills, so it turned into a family trip. Even though the whole family made it out physically unharmed, the trauma of that day still lingers. Genesis has slept in Erica's bed ever since the shooting.
She always dreads the time when we're going to go to sleep. Like, she'd be like, I don't want to go to sleep. And she gets really moody and she starts talking about hug me because I'm scared.
Genesis is in therapy and trying different techniques to help her sleep, like listening to calming music before bed. Erica says the resiliency center that was set up after the attack has been especially helpful for her family. She has a case manager who regularly checks in and drops off care packages. And she's trying to model resiliency for her family. The day the Walmart reopened, Erica was one of the first ones through the door.
I wanted to face it because I said, I'm not going to live in fear.
It's not just Genesis she's concerned about. For a while, Erica's mom stayed shut inside, afraid to leave the house.
She, you know, had her moments when she was breaking down and didn't want to go nowhere. But I told her, Mom, that's not a way to live.
Then coronavirus happened and led to this weird, contradictory shift. For months, she and her sister had been practically dragging their mom out of her house. Now they had to reverse course.
Now that it's the COVID, now she wants to be going out. And she's like, first you get mad at me because I don't go out, and now because I want to go out.
Despite the pandemic, the family had been making steady progress. Erica says most days she was doing pretty well. But as the one-year mark approached, that started to change.
I've been dealing with a lot of anxiety and, you know, not being able to sleep properly again. And it's just something you just don't want to remember anymore.
Lately, she's been avoiding the Walmart she was so determined to revisit after the attack. Erica will be relieved when the one-year mark has passed. She wants to focus on moving forward and not letting this event define her family.
What he did doesn't change who we are. We're still going to continue fighting. We're still going to continue living our life. We're still going to be happy.
And not let August 3rd be a reason to close themselves off from the world. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Earlier this week, the Trump administration ordered states to start picking up part of the tab for National Guard deployment used to aid in coronavirus response. But as Politico reports, there were two notable exceptions, Florida and Texas. While other states will be on the hook for 25% of their National Guard costs, Texas and Florida's bills will be covered in full. State officials in Florida and Texas applauded the decision, while Democratic Governors Association members accused the administration of playing politics. The National Guard Association told Politico they received no explanation of why Florida and Texas are exempt. And so far, the White House hasn't explained the decision either. Coming up on 39 minutes past the hour.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, offering annual preventative and screening appointments with safety protocols in place. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The leading contemporary art museum in North Texas is shutting its doers for the rest of the year. KERA's Jerome Weeks reports the Dallas Contemporary has become the first sizable North Texas arts organization to officially write off the next 6 months because of COVID-19.
The Dallas Contemporary thrives on staying current with new shows, unconventional projects. Its home is a converted warehouse in the Design District. The giant galleries there challenge artists to dream big dreams. And with a full-time staff of only 8, the Contemporary doesn't have a lot of overhead. It may need a steady supply of new artworks, but it can also change things up.
It's trying to keep that balance of making fast decisions and reacting quickly, but also sometimes our projects take 2-3 years to even figure out what can be done in our spaces.
Peter Doroshenko is the executive director of the Dallas Contemporary. He says the museum temporarily closed in March because of COVID, with 2 new shows waiting to happen. Perhaps they could simply reschedule for September.
But by the time June 1 rolled around, we actually saw things getting worse. So we thought it'll be impossible for us to open to the public in a safe manner, especially since all the shows are basically new commissions for us. All the artists will be coming from different parts of the world, and we just decided it was too many spinning plates.
When it comes to keeping people COVID safe during cultural events, it's the performing arts organizations, theaters, and music groups, not the art museums, that have really struggled with reopening, protecting actors and backstage crew and audience members from infection. That's complicated. The Dallas Theater Center hopes to reopen in November, but as far back as May, artistic director Kevin Moriarty worried theaters might cancel their entire seasons.
It could be the fall of 2021 before we see live performance return in any meaningful way.
In contrast, some art museums have already reopened. The wide galleries make social distancing more convenient than sitting in theater seats. And of course, there's no touching the artworks. The public feels safer in museums. Most of the major Dallas museums do remain closed. The Crow Collection, the Nasher Sculpture Center, and the Dallas Museum of Art. But they are considering a collective reopening sometime. So the Dallas Contemporary's decision to shut its doors and go entirely online for 6 months is unusual among museums. But then the Contemporary is unusual. For one thing, it is free admission. Carolina Alvarez-Matthes is the Contemporary's deputy director.
We have always been free and remain free admissions. That's not something that we needed to necessarily consider.
Instead of relying on paid admissions, the Contemporary raises all the money for its nearly $2 million annual budget from grants, donations, and sales. Fundraising for cultural organizations has become harder lately in the face of the pressures caused by COVID and the ongoing social upheaval over racism. Even so, Doroshenko says, he doesn't foresee laying off staff or cutting salaries.
believe it or not, we have been, since the pandemic started, very engaged in grants writing, and we've been extremely successful. At this point, we're at 100%.
Alvarez Mathis sees the contemporary 6 months of downtime as a chance for the institution to become as innovative as the artists it shows.
I think it's about looking at the future and saying, what can we reimagine? What can we invent?
The contemporary was online before the pandemic hit, but since then, it's put up interviews and exhibitions. It's hosted virtual panels about cultural organizations helping to dismantle systemic racism. Now it's planning what it calls an expanded e-commerce platform. That's an online museum shop. The ambitions don't stop there.
We're going to be launching a journal called Art Digest, and it'll be expanding on what we're doing, and not just doing it with artists, but also writers, critics, playwrights, really kind of the gamut of what creative culture is all about.
So the dreams are still big, but the doors will be closed for at least 6 more months. In Dallas, I'm Jerome Weeks.
Before Hurricane Hanna made landfall last week, President Trump approved an emergency disaster declaration for the Rio Grande Valley. It makes it easier for the region to get funding if needed, but some in the RGV aren't betting on it to arrive soon. As Victoria Guerrero told Texas Standard, the region often feels neglected and ignored by the rest of the nation.
A lot of people, when they think of South Texas, they think of San Antonio, and they don't realize that there's 1.4 million people living beneath San Antonio. There's a very large populous region called the Rio Grande Valley that has thriving communities, but oftentimes people don't realize we exist. And so what happened on Good Morning America was a meteorologist during their broadcast stated that Hurricane Hanna's biggest impact would hit the land between Corpus Christi and Brownsville, Texas, Brownsville being in the Rio Grande Valley. And they stated it in a way that made it seem like any place was a good place for a natural disaster to hit. And it angered a lot of Rio Grande Valley residents for the simple fact that it was pretty insensitive. Those people still matter, and there's never a good place for a natural disaster to hit, especially considering the destruction that natural disasters cause. Like, it didn't just hit that small patch of land between Corpus and Brownsville. It flew through and devastated our entire region. It frustrated us the most for the simple fact that there isn't a lot of national coverage talking about Hurricane Hanna. There's a lot of people in the country right now who don't even know Hurricane Hanna happened, who don't even know that it really, really, really destroyed parts of our community. People's homes were destroyed, and that's going to take a very long time to come back from. That kind of just emulates how the nation as a whole thinks about the Rio Grande Valley. For the fact that a lot of people don't know we exist, and a lot of people don't keep us in mind when they are thinking of current events, when in reality, a lot of current events do occur from a broad spectrum of things right here in the Rio Grande Valley, but we're not really getting any national coverage on that. And when we don't receive media coverage on these important things that are happening in a region, it doesn't give us any aid. It doesn't help us provide for these families who, you know, whose homes were destroyed. It doesn't help us get FEMA down here faster. It really doesn't do us any good if people aren't talking about the devastation that this hurricane brought. So RGV Mutual Aid Fund is a collective that a group of community organizers located in the Rio Grande Valley started post-Hurricane Hanna. After we realized that, one, our region is often neglected by the state and even sometimes local government, we realized that now it's almost a week later and hurricane relief efforts have not come to our region. They have not come to our counties. And after seeing the destruction that a Category 1 hurricane started, here in the Rio Grande Valley, I actually created the Mutual Aid Fund with the hopes that our donations can give direct, immediate financial aid into the hands of those people who were negatively impacted. In the meantime, while we are waiting for our government to intervene and grant us hurricane relief, we're just trying to help each other out.
Victoria Guerrero is creator of the RGV Mutual Aid Fund. You can learn more about the group at texasstandard.org. It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. MJ Hager, the Democrat running to replace John Cornyn in the U.S. Senate, says that nearly one in three Texans don't have access to health insurance. Is that a fact? Looking into this is Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, good to speak with you again.
Good to speak with you, too.
So how did this claim come up in the first place?
So we actually have two claims that we're looking at here today. This came up during a virtual victory party that Hagar was holding after winning her runoff election to become the Democratic nominee earlier this year. And she was talking about how there's been a healthcare crisis in this state before COVID-19. And she went on to talk about insurance coverage and access to insurance. And we have audio of her remarks.
Well, let's listen to it.
Before the pandemic, we had nearly one out of every five without access to healthcare coverage. And now, one in three, nearly one in three Texans under the age of 65 don't have access to healthcare insurance because of the record unemployment and because of our healthcare model that's failing Texas.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. This really is a two-part claim. I suppose we should begin with that first part, that nearly one in five people did not have access to healthcare coverage before the pandemic, right?
That's right. And as I'm sure you know, Texas consistently ranks as the state with the highest rate of uninsured people in the country.
Right.
And these figures that she shared are exactly right according to the latest data we have from the Census Bureau, which is analyzing 2018 insurance levels. So during that year, more than 4.8 million people under 65 were uninsured. That's about one in five people. Of those who weren't insured, they mostly were covered through their employer, and the rest were covered through Medicaid, military insurance, or another option.
All right. I want to get back to something, though, that you just said. You said that the latest insurance data we have is from 2018, if I heard you correctly. How can we talk about insurance coverage during the pandemic?
That's a great question. And what we have to do is turn to these reports that have come out that are looking to assess the impact of job losses during the pandemic on insurance coverage, because this pandemic has had an effect in so many corners of our lives, and a really significant one has been unemployment. We've seen that unemployment rate really fluctuate since the start of this. It was 13.5% in April, fell to 8.6% in June, and as people lost their jobs, many also lost their health insurance coverage.
So I guess this is especially important to note because of the second part of her claim. She says now nearly one in three Texans under the age of 65 don't have access to health care insurance because of the record unemployment and the health care model that is failing Texas, in her words. So what do the experts have to say about this nearly one in three claim?
Right. So the reports I looked at tried to put an estimate for this number because it is kind of a moving target. These were looking at the earlier part of the year from May and earlier. And so those numbers may be a bit different now, but this is the best available data we have at this point in time. One was more of an overestimate. It was looking at everybody that lost their job and then lost health insurance, but it didn't factor in the fact that some people then may be able to find other coverage, either through their spouse's insurance, through Medicaid, or another option. The best report that we were able to find to speak to this came from Families USA, and it looked specifically at people who lost coverage but were then unable to secure coverage elsewhere. And that brings us to that number that she said. It shows that about one in three adults don't have healthcare insurance right now. And that's actually likely an underestimate because that study didn't include adult dependents or children who may also have been relying on that employer health care.
Well, by my reckoning, it sounds like you might be ready for a ruling. Is that right?
I'm ready if you are.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
Based on the best available information we have right now, we rate this claim true.
True. MJ Hager's twin claim that one in five Texans did not have health insurance coverage before the pandemic, and now roughly one in three Texans under the age of 65 don't have access to health care insurance. Madeline Meckelberg and the folks at PolitiFact Texas did the numbers. They're based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Joining us once again, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, with the talk of Texas. What are Texans talking about on this Wednesday, Wells?
Howdy, David. Well, following up on one story we heard about earlier in the show, the news that the census counting efforts are ending a month early under apparent pressure from the Trump administration. Hearing from some of our friends and listeners online about that, this tweet from Hung Nguyen, he notes that it's hard to deny that this is a political move, but the effects are going to be indiscriminate. He adds, it will hit hard against the federal representation and resources available to Texas, a largely red state. Kind of does raise the question of the political motivation here, as there are these reports that the White House has applied pressure to wrap the count up early. What is the motivation there? Similarly, via Facebook, Barbara Stansfield Terry says this about the actual process of filling out the form. She notes that she was a bit late, but it went smoothly online and became a learning experience for the near adult in our household. I heard that from several other people that it sort of became a family event here, as you know, obviously families spend so much time together here in lockdown. Something to do with the kids, if you will. Seeing a little bit of interesting breaking news here as well. This report that speakers for the 2020 Democratic National Convention no longer have to travel to Milwaukee. This in order to cut down on travel and the potential spread of COVID-19. Apparently, Joe Biden plans on addressing the nation and accepting the Democratic nomination from his home in Delaware. What we're seeing there from the DNC, from the committee overseeing things. Also been seeing some chatter about the Republicans' plans for the national convention there as well. I think we learned a few days ago that Governor Greg Abbott won't be leaving Texas to attend. Instead, he's apparently sending Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick in his stead. That provoking no short amount of reaction via Facebook as well. There, Gwendolyn writes that, I guess Dan Patrick is putting his money where his mouth is and is prepared to travel after all, referring to those controversial comments from the lieutenant governor saying we need to sort of open things back up, get back to some semblance of normal, even if it does have some health impacts there, or deaths, even as the lieutenant governor has stated. Obviously, developing stories that lots of people are keeping an eye on as we near November. Can you believe, what, like 3 months away now or something, David? What's going 90 on?
90 days. 90 days until Election Day. It's just hard to believe. Already there's an interesting write-up about the next big political event beyond that in Texas. That's the legislature. There have been some questions raised by Ross Ramsey over there at the Texas Tribune about whether or not the Texas legislature can meet for 140 days. Of course, they can, but should they? That's going to be coming up just in the start of the new year, and there are a lot of bills and issues to consider, not the least of which how the state has been dealing with the pandemic and a near-record shortfall. This may well be a record once all is said and done. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org. And, of course, we invite you to join us once again on the radio tomorrow. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the team, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.